You can have it all, so they tell us. You can work harder, play harder, and multitask your way to squeezing 31 hours of activity into a 24-hour day. Did you know that? Rob's looking at me like I'm nuts. Well, that's the finding of a study conducted by the American Management Association. The study concluded that people can add almost 50% more activity to a typical day of 16 waking hours. Similarly, according to U.S. Labor Department figures, the average yearly increase in U.S. workers' productivity has doubled from 1.5% during the period from 1987 to 1996 to 3% from 1997 to 2006. Doubled productivity. Statistically getting more hours in the day. At least more out of the hours in the day. But what's the price tag? Through technology, people are accomplishing more in less time, but they're feeling overwhelmed by the multiplicity of their lives, according to Ed Riley, CEO of the AMA. There's a sense of fatigue that comes from multitasking, he says. You can force yourself to keep doing things, but you may not be as effective. As one writer put it, the problem with living life in the fast lane, you get to the toll booth quicker. Pressure has a price tag. Sooner or later, we have to pay the price of dealing with pressure. King Saul, in 1 Samuel chapter 13, has jumped into the fast lane. Almost overnight, he has gone from a sleepy farmer looking for his donkeys to the king of Israel facing national security threats from multiple enemies all at once. He's jumped from a rural road to a 10-lane expressway. He is multitasking. Everything, the pressure is there on him. He is under real pressure. And that pressure is going to reveal Saul's character. You see, God tests our character with pressure. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 1. Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 32 years over Israel. Now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. And the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash, east of Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves, in thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and in pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. Now, before we continue, let me deal with a little problem of chronology in verse 1 for just a minute. The Hebrew literally reads, "Saul was a son of a year when he reigned, and 2 years he reigned over Israel." Most translations, like the one I read from, supply some numbers that you will notice are in italics because they're not in the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Bible. They're editorial insertions. So there are two ways to look at the chronology that is going on in this section. The first way is quite common, that there is a textual problem and we have to supply the numbers. That's why translators editorially have supplied numbers. They have assumed that this is a summary of Saul's life here and that certain numbers were left out of that in the biblical text, in the text that we have anyway. And many argue that there must have been at least 10 or even 20 years that took place between chapter 12 and chapter 13. But there is no textual evidence that something is missing and that we should insert numbers. So instead of a summary of Saul's life, I think it's better to see this as a snapshot of his current situation. The first year then refers to the time he was waiting for coronation, and the 2 years refers to his reign until chapter 13, when he was rejected by God. The expression, son of a year, could refer to the unusual circumstances by which he became king. Most kings were crown princes, so they were the son of the king from birth. They were the crown prince from birth, the son of a year. But Saul didn't come to the kingship that way. He was anointed by Samuel, so he was the son of the king for a year, and then it has been only 2 years until we arrive to chapter 13. The 2 years refers to the time between his becoming king and now in chapter 13. In essence, the 2 years refers to his reign between the time that he became king and the time that he was rejected by God as king. In other words, in God's eyes, Saul only reigns 2 years. Chapter 13. Now I say all of that to point out how rapidly Saul was put under pressure. He literally jumped into the fast lane and he came to the toll booth long before he expected to have to pay the price. God uses this intense pressure to reveal Saul's true character. And that is how God works with us with regard to pressure as well. God uses pressure in our lives. And you all face it at various times. It may be job-related, it may be family-related, it may be health-related, it may be all of the above all at once. It does seem like things just pile up, don't they? And the pressure comes. But God uses that pressure to reveal our character. And how we function under pressure reveals who we really are. We can fake it when everything is going well. It's hard to fake it when we're under pressure. Then we find out what we're made of and if we're truly committed to following God or not. Under pressure, we find out if we are men and women of integrity. Do we keep our commitments? Do we keep our word? Even when it costs us something. We can only find out these things under pressure. So let's find out how God used pressure in Saul's life to reveal his true character. And he'll do the same with David later. Saul, we know, fails it. David passes the pressure test in his life, or is in his early life. Saul chooses an army of 3,000 men. He sets himself up with 2,000 at Michmash, and his son Jonathan leads 1,000 men at their hometown of Gibeah. The rest of the people were sent home to continue their normal lives. Saul is about 5 miles away, that's all, from Jonathan. That's all the distance between Michmash and Gibeah. Jonathan is the one, however, who strikes the first blow against the Philistines. Although Saul, you notice, quickly takes credit for the victory over the Philistines. Looking out from his hometown of Gibeah, Jonathan could see the Philistine military garrison on the hilltop of Geba across the little valley. He could watch their troop movements. In fact, He probably has watched them for years, for the Philistine garrison has been there for quite some time, and looked for the opportunity now that he has soldiers to attack. We're told nothing about this first battle. Perhaps Jonathan waited for a time when he could ambush the soldiers, but at any rate, he defeats the Philistines in battle, he takes Geba for Israel, and word is quickly sent to his father, word quickly spreads to the Philistines as well. Saul seizes the moment, he blows the military trumpet for the other soldiers to join the army. Battle is coming from the Philistines. Now Saul's message is interesting here. He says, "Let the Hebrews hear." That's an odd expression. It's odd because the Israelites didn't refer to themselves as Hebrews unless it was in a derogatory sense. It was used by their enemies as a derogatory term for the Israelites. For Saul to say, "Let the Hebrews hear," makes us wonder what the message is that he's trying to deliver here. And many have speculated that Saul was appealing to the Israelites who had joined the Philistines for economic and security reasons. In essence, they had gone over to be a part of the Philistine life. And so he asks the Hebrews, "Let the Hebrews hear," essentially, "let the traitors hear, come join us in battle. We're going to battle, we're fighting." By the way, in 1 Samuel 14 and verse 21, the Hebrews that are referred there, the people called the Hebrews, are people who were part of the Philistine army and in their encampment, and they leave the Philistines to join the Israelites when victory comes. So that's the way the term Hebrew is often used. Saul withdraws from Michmash. The Philistine army sets up its base camp here at Michmash. They've gathered a huge army. I mean, this is almost overkill. 30,000 chariots. Chariots in the ancient world were the similar to, say, tanks in World War II, or nuclear weapons today. They were the prime weapon. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 cavalry, along with a large army of foot soldiers. It is an overwhelming display of power by the Philistines, and it accomplished its purpose. The Israelites are scared. Saul's little army was poorly equipped. We find out later that the Philistines controlled all of the ability to make weaponry in order to keep the Israelites from making their own weapons, and that the Israelites only have homemade weapons even, let alone the fact that the Israelites are not even trained for warfare. Saul was in trouble. He knew it. This wasn't working out well. The pressure was coming. He was king. What was he going to do? He withdrew to form his army at Gilgal, where he had only a short time before been crowned as king, 1 Samuel chapter 12. Here he hoped to regroup the army, set up a plan to fight the Philistines. But the people are scared. It says they come to Gilgal trembling. They were scared. They were in no shape to fight. So God has set up Saul for this character test. The pressure is intense. Everyone was looking to him for leadership. What are you going to do here, Saul? What are we going to do? He didn't know what to do. The enemy was amassing its army for total annihilation. They would massacre the new king and all his people in a few short days. Talk about pressure. This was pressure. The people were hiding out. They were hiding out in wine cellars. They were hiding out in thickets. They were hiding out in pits. They were running across the Jordan River to get away from all the fighting. What are you going to do, Saul? This is a character test from God. You like God's character tests? I don't. They're tough. In 1990, the University of Colorado football team won the national championship. They never should have won the championship that year because they won on the basis of a major error by the officials. They were trailing the University of Missouri by four points with time running out in the game that year. Colorado had a first down near the goal line. Four times they tried to score a touchdown, and four times they were stopped. There were 2 seconds left in the game. Now, those of you who follow football, those of you who don't follow football, you only get four downs, right? The officials gave them a fifth down, miscounted the downs. And on the fifth down, with 2 seconds left in the game, they scored a touchdown and went on to win the national championship. All of the replays proved that Colorado had won by illegal means. When asked about it afterwards, Colorado coach Bill McCartney shrugged his shoulders and said it wasn't his problem. "I feel strongly about the fact that Colorado earned the victory and do not apologize for the victory at all," he said. Many called for them to give the game back and forfeit the championship, which, by the way, had been done before in the NCAA. He refused. All right, so that's a story about football. But here's the problem. Bill McCartney is an out-and-out vocal Christian leader, founder of the Promise Keepers movement. That promotes solid values for men in this country. Yet, under pressure, he violated the very principles he was teaching men, or wanted to teach them, in order to win a championship. Now, I don't say this to pick on Coach McCartney. In fact, he has since said on numerous occasions that he regrets many of the decisions he made as a coach. Because following Christ is more important than winning football games. So he has said that repeatedly. I'm not here to pick on him. I'm here to say that's what pressure does to us. When we're put under pressure, we can make mistakes, we can do wrong, we can sin, we can fail under pressure. And the world is watching us. And the world looks at that as a failure of Christianity. In fact, where I got the story is from a book that records it and makes note of the fact that this is a Christian, a vocal Christian leader who did this. You see, what happens is we show those flaws, don't we, in our character under pressure. It comes out. And every one of us, it can happen to. Well, that's exactly what happened to Saul. And second principle this morning, little flaws reveal major heart problems. Verse 8. "Now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, 'Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering.' And he offered the burnt offering, and it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. But Samuel said, 'What have you done?' And Saul said, 'Because I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the appointed days and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal. And I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering.' And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have literally been a fool. You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. You have been a fool, Saul. The Lord has sought another man out, one who is after his heart, not like you. and you've lost your kingdom. It's already done. Now, I don't know about you, but I read that passage and I feel sympathy for Saul. It doesn't feel right. It seems so harsh of God to judge him under those circumstances. I mean, he was trying after all. It was a pressure cooker of a situation. He was trying to do what God wanted. Doesn't he get credit for trying? I mean, when I fail to obey God exactly, does that mean God's just going to toss me aside? You're done. That's it. I'm done with you. I mean, I want for Coach McCartney some grace. Because I want grace for me and mercy. Wow, this is hard, God. I mean, did he really do stuff that was that bad? Well, what does Saul do? What did he do? He's waiting for Samuel at Gilgal. Samuel had told him back in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 8, that he was to go to Gilgal and wait for 7 days for Samuel to come and perform the sacrifices. And Samuel, God would, through Samuel, tell him what was next, what he was to do, how he was to handle things. So Saul is trying to obey God. He waits for 7 days, almost. See, Saul's disease is the almost but not quite disease. He waits for the 7 days, almost. On the 7th day, he decides to take matters into his own hands, perform the sacrifice himself. He didn't wait the full 7 days. He waited almost the full 7 days. But the army was deserting him. In fact, we find out in this chapter later on that of the 3,000 he had, he was down to 600 by the end. I mean, they were walking away in droves. And that huge army was coming. He had to do something, didn't he? He had to take matters into his own hands, didn't he? Doesn't that make sense? I got to do something. I'm the king. The pressure is on me. The people are looking to me for an answer here. What am I going to do? Saul, you're a fool. Doesn't sound terribly foolish, but Saul, you're a fool. That's God's indictment. It seems like such a little thing, but Saul, you've lost your kingdom. It's done. 2 years, finished. So our first inclination is to defend Saul. Why did God make him wait to the 11th hour? But you see, the test is not so much the sacrifice he performs or the fact that he cut short his wait by a few hours. The issue God is getting at is inside his heart. The action that he takes is a symptom of a deeper issue, a character issue. And that's what God is getting at when we're put under pressure. It's not the issue itself. It's the character, heart, the heart issue, the stuff inside of us. The new song we sang talks about from the inside out, you see. That's what God is getting at in his test. The test is designed by God to reveal what is inside Saul's heart. And here's the problem. Saul has a heart problem. He does not trust God. That's the problem. He didn't trust God. God had been very specific what to do, and he didn't trust God enough to wait. He's not a man of integrity, we would say. He waffles. He gives in to pressure. He fails to keep his commitments under that pressure, to keep his word. Inside, Saul is really rebelling against God. And that's the heart issue. It is the sign of a rebellious heart. That's why God is so harsh. And it will be repeated in Saul again and again and again throughout his life. So we know it is his heart that is rebellious against God. He doesn't trust God, and he is rebelling against God. That's an integrity issue. Let's review our working definition of integrity from Stephen Carter's book on integrity. Integrity requires three steps: discerning what is right and what is wrong, acting on what you have discerned, even at personal cost. Three, saying openly that you are acting on your understanding of right from wrong. In this case, like all moral issues, God has already spoken about what is right and what is wrong. And Saul was to wait 7 days, and Samuel would perform the sacrifice and reveal God's will. To do the sacrifice was actually then to rebel against God's direct command to him. And how often do I hear people read a command of God here and do just the opposite? That is rebellion. And it violates step number one. Saul also violated step number two. He didn't obey because in his mind the cost was too high. Everybody was deserting him. And so often we choose to follow our own path instead of waiting for God because we aren't willing to pay the price of integrity. Every character test has a price to pay. That's the way God designs it. We find out what we're made of when we're willing to pay the price. Will we keep our commitment even though it will cost us something to keep that commitment? Or will we quickly start waffling, blaming others, figuring out new ways, rationalizing? Will we just shut our mouths and do what we know God wants us to do? Or will we respond to the pressure of others and give in, start waffling? Finally, Saul violated step number three. The people were pressuring him to do something. What could he have done? He could have stood up and said, God has told me to wait till Samuel gets here. We'll have a sacrifice and God will solve this problem. That's trust. That's surrender. But he didn't stand up and say anything like that, did he? He didn't speak out to show that he was doing, that what he was doing was to honor God first in his life. Golfer Chelsea Richard of Bloomingdale High School in Brandon, Florida, high school golfer, lost her chance to win the 2004 state championship in Florida by being honest. In the qualifier for the state finals, Chelsea hit her tee shot on the second hole into the rough. Without knowing it, she played another golfer's ball out of the rough, finished the hole. On the third hole, she realized what she had done. By rule, a golfer must declare the wrong ball penalty before putting on that hole where the infraction occurred or be disqualified. That's the rules. Sound harsh? But all sports play by rules, right? That's the rule. Drawing strength from her favorite Bible verse, Philippians 4:13, Chelsea reported her error, ending her senior season and her dream of a state championship. She was automatically disqualified. She later said, "With my faith and with God, being honest was the most important thing to me, and that's what is going to advance on throughout my life, being honest and making the right choices." Integrity. She passed on all three counts. High school senior. Saul did not.
What does Saul do? First of all, he blames other people for his choices. He blames the soldiers for running away and leaving him in this mess. He blames Samuel for not being there to help him. He blames the Philistines for attacking him. This is usually the first sign of a heart problem, an integrity problem, if you will. We blame others for our choices. We confess, but we confess in a way that points the fingers at other people. We don't take personal responsibility for our part in the problem, for our choices. Confession should never be confession of someone else's failures, it's ours. We shift the blame to other people. That's the first sign of an integrity problem. Second, Saul offers excuses for his choices. The army was deserting me. The situation was reaching crisis mode. I felt all alone. I didn't know what to do. And where were you when I needed you? Speaking of that, Samuel, where in the world were you 5 minutes ago? What, poof, you just materialize? You let me down. Excuses. We make excuses, and the better the excuses, the better we look. And third, we lie. Saul lied. He lied by deception, by going out to Samuel pretending as if everything was okay. He lied when he said that Samuel had not arrived on the appointed day, because Samuel did arrive on the seventh day. And then the whopper came. He lied when he said he forced himself to offer a sacrifice as if he had no other choice. These were lies, and often when we're under pressure and we fail, we try to cover up with lies. All right, Saul was being tested. Would he follow God or would he go his own way and seek his own solutions? So this was a heart test, not just a minor action test. Will Saul follow God as God directed him through Samuel, or would Saul circumvent the direction? Would he try to get around the restrictions and the guidance? So now when we put it in that light, we don't have as much sympathy for Saul, do we? For God was testing his heart. And God does the same with us. Before we can ever be leaders, we have to be followers. Followership is the first test of leadership. God calls us to follow Him. He calls us to a high standard of personal integrity. He calls us to be obedient in the little stuff of life. The issue, you see, is not the little failures. The issue is the underlying rebellion that is demonstrated in those little failures. We get a glimpse of Saul's heart disease here, but we're going to see it over and over and over and over again in his life. When faced with pressure, Saul will try to find a way around things. He will try to circumvent God's directives over and over again in life. So will we follow God in the little details of our lives? Or will we look for ways around God's boundaries? That's the test of our hearts. Sheep wander. And in recent times, shepherds have turned to some rather sophisticated methods to protect them. One method is a metal hoof-proof grid, 8 feet wide, that shepherds have been using around the perimeter of the pasture, because when sheep try to cross this grid, this metal grid, their hoofs get stuck and they can't get across the grid. Seemed like a workable solution. But early in 2006, shepherds in Yorkshire, England, found that they had a group of sheep who figured out how to get out. It seems that one of the sheep discovered they could roll over the grid. 8 feet of rolling and they were free. And the other sheep said, "Whoa, this is a great idea." So the other sheep went rolling across the grid too. And off they went, eating the neighbors' gardens and flowers and everything else. And the shepherds got them all back in. What did they do? Rolled over the grid, and out they went again. And again and again and again. It didn't work once they figured out, once a leader of the sheep figured out how to bypass the system. And we thought sheep were stupid. No, sheep are really stubborn. That's what they are. And guess what God likens us to? Sheep. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. We find a way to roll over the grid. That's what Saul did, and that's what we do, and that is rebellion. That's a heart issue. And it is what the Bible calls presumptuous sin. We know better, and we still do it. Presumptuous sins blossom from rebellious hearts. That's Saul's message to us. Years ago, I watched a movie called A River Runs Through It. It's a fascinating story of human family dynamics. It was quite interesting, really. It's the story of an American family in the early 1900s in rural Montana. Two sons, Norman and Paul, grow up under very strict rules of their legalistic minister father. Norman, however, grows up to make some good choices in life and lead a fairly successful life, even if he didn't like his father's strict rules. Paul, the younger son, spends most of his time and his life in self-destructive behavior and ends up making a mess, a total mess of his life. There's one scene that the movie uses early as a parable of what's to come. And in that scene, the family is seated at dinner. 8-year-old Paul sits at the table staring at a full bowl of porridge. Everyone else has finished their meal and is sitting quietly, has finished their breakfast. Reverend McLean says, "Grace will not be said until that bowl is clear." He sets his cup down and he says calmly, "Man has been eating God's oats for 1,000 years. It's not the place of an 8-year-old boy to change that tradition." End of discussion. Paul continues to sit quietly, doesn't say a thing. Everyone waits for a response. There's no response. The clock in the next scene shows 12:15. And Paul sits alone, still staring at his bowl. His father is at a desk on the far side of the room. Reverend McLean walks to the kitchen table. His wife and his son, other son Norman, join him. The three sit down and stare at Paul. It's lunchtime now. Reverend McLean says, "Grace." All four stand up, kneel beside their chairs, put their hands together. Reverend McLean prays, "O God, thou art rich in forgiveness. Grant that we may hold fast the good things we receive from thee, and as often as we fall into sin, we are lifted by repentance through thy grace. Amen." Norman steals a peek at his brother Paul. The bowl of porridge is still full. He will never eat that bowl of porridge. And it becomes a sign of the rebellious life to come. A little thing reveals a heart problem. Presumptuous sin blossoms in a rebellious heart. God deliver us from rebellious hearts. Father, you test our hearts, not because the tests themselves are the critical issue, but because our hearts are. I pray, Lord, that you will help us to surrender our wills to you and to follow you as you lead us in life. In Jesus' name, amen.